Welcome, everybody. Part two of the three-part series after a fascinating talk last week on Susanna. This week, Josephus, I guess, who's in theory a little bit more well-known, but I don't know how much more well-known. Okay, so Rabbi, we'll let you take it away.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Shavuot Tov. It's nice to see everybody on a Sunday morning. Happy Mother's Day to everybody. My series here, my three lectures, are on literature of the Second Temple period. And again, I began last week pointing out the fact that we don't know very much about the Second Temple period. We have literature on the First Temple, that's what we call Tanakh. We have literature of the post-destruction period, that's what we call Gemara. And next week we'll talk a little bit about that transition when we talk about the Mishnah. But these 3 weeks, what I want to do is, or at least these 2 weeks, what I want to do is, I want to look at literature that was written during the Second Temple. Last week, we looked at religious literature that was written during the Second Temple, which basically means literature that was religious, but for some reason was not included in the Tanakh. And we looked at the story of Susanna and the elders, and I thought that was an interesting study because we actually studied it, and it seemed like it should have been part of Tanakh, and we discussed why it wasn't part of Tanakh. Today, what I want to look at is the first, and again, whenever you say the first, I'm going to always say, but I have something beforehand. So I would say the first most famous example of non-religious literature during the Second Temple period. And that is the work of a historian by the name of Josephus. Now, he's not the first one. There was Philo and there were others. But in terms of the way we remember it, I would say that Josephus is the most important historian from this period. Let's see, who was Josephus and why is he important in the study of Second Temple and why does he remain important to this day? Well, first of all, when do we place him? Where was he born? So Josephus was born around the year 38 CE. Just to give you a little snapshot of what that means. The temple is destroyed in the year 70 CE. What was going on in Israel in the year 38 CE? So around the year 164, the Hashmonaim beat the Greeks. We know that. And for about 100 years, the Hashmonaim controlled the land of Israel, Judea. Then in the year 63, the Romans took over, and the Romans controlled Judea, controlled Jerusalem, but more or less, it was a hands-off policy. They had a governor who governed Judea, who governed in Jerusalem. Most of the time, he basically had a live and let live attitude towards the Jews. That changed in the end, but more or less, he had a live and let live attitude. So the Jews continued in their daily lives with the temple. Now, the Jews themselves had two groups during this period. One were called the Sadducees and one were called the Pharisees. The Sadducees, they were the aristocracy. They were the priests. They were the Kohanim. They had all the power. They're the ones who worked in the temple. The Pharisees became the rabbis later. But they clearly were of secondary importance during the time of the temple. As well, we know there were the breakaway groups, the Essenes, who lived in the desert, who lived in the Judean hills. We may refer to them a little bit, which is also interesting. Now, the first important thing to know about Josephus is part of the aristocracy. Josephus' father is a priest, is a Kohen, and his mother comes from the family of the Hashmonaim. That was the best yichus you could have, right? His mother was a Hashmonai. So he starts off with very, very good yichus. And you know, in those days, you're brought up based on your yichus. You're educated based on your yichus. Your friends are based on your yichus. So therefore, he is brought up in an aristocratic setting. And it seems to be, at least he claims, and we're going to have a lot of this, he claims and what the truth is, but he claims that he actually was known to the scholars of the period and the leaders of the period. And he actually, they consulted with him and he consulted with them. He also claims at one point that he spends some time in his youth with one of the sects in the Judean Hills, which also was kind of interesting that he was exposed to the sects. The first moment in Josephus's life takes place in the year 64 CE. At the age of 26, he's sent by the priests to Rome to secure the release of some other priests who had been seized and sent to Rome by the procurator, by the governor Felix. Now, that story is important for a couple of things. Number one is they chose somebody who they felt was gifted enough to negotiate the release of these priests. That's also important. Probably the reason they chose him was because he was educated. He knew Greek. Most people didn't know Greek. He knew Greek. But also he was someone who was very well respected, even in his youth at 26. And he's the one who they sent. And he was successful. Now, the interesting thing about this story is the fact that he writes that he fell in love with Rome. That's not so surprising to us. You know, you go to a city in your youth and you fall in love with the city and somehow you say, I'm going to return to this city. So that's not only true in the 21st century, that was true in the first century also. Josephus, at the age of 26, falls in love with Rome. But he comes back and the situation continues until the year 66. In the year 66, we have the Great Revolt. The Great Revolt is the beginning of the battle between what we would call the Jews and the Romans. It was a battle that took place, and ultimately in 70, it led to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. But in the 4 years prior, actually, there were two locations for the battle. There was the Galilee in the north where they had these battles. And they had And they had a battle in Jerusalem. They had a battle in the Galilee, and they had a battle in Jerusalem. Now, Josephus, interestingly, is appointed the commander of the Judean forces in the Galilee. And that was clearly the most important position at the time. The war began in the Galilee, and Josephus was given that position. Now, that became extremely controversial because the Galilean Jews, the Jews in the north, they thought they should have one of their own as the leader. So basically what happened was, and this is not so surprising, what happened was you have the Jews fighting with one another about who should lead the Jewish forces in the north. The Galilean Jews want to have one of their own. And then you have the Jews of Jerusalem who've chosen one of their own, Josephus. Josephus travels to the Galilee, and he leads the battle. Now, the Roman general at the time is someone who became famous. He became the emperor. His name was Vespasian. He arrives in the year 67. According to Josephus's report, when he arrives in 67, the Jews are basically just fighting with one another. And they're in no position to fight back against Vespasian. The famous battle at that time was a battle of Jotapata, Jotapata. Jotapata was a city, was a town, a place in the north in the Galilee. They fought for 6 weeks. The city fell, and the Jews were forced to hide in caves to protect themselves. Now, the story as we have it is that Josephus, as the leader of the troops, as the commander in chief, was taken by Vespasian, and he was threatened with execution. However, at that moment, Josephus offers a prophecy that Vespasian will become emperor, kind of like a Yochanan ben Zakkai kind of story. And then when it came true, in the end, they didn't kill Josephus. Now, exactly what the real story is, it's not entirely clear. It may be, as often happens, that Josephus was lucky. He kind of was able to be threatened with execution, but the emperor at the time didn't actually kill him. And by the time Vespasian became the emperor, as we'll see in a minute, he felt that Josephus played a much more important role in another position that he had. And what is that? So, the Romans defeat the Jews in the Galilee. The next thing they want to do is they want to go to Jerusalem. Now, exactly what their motive was in going to Jerusalem is not clear. And this you have to keep in mind. We know that it led eventually to the destruction of the temple in 70 CE. The question is, did they actually want to destroy the temple when they started? Or would they have been happy just to have the Jews surrender? Well, actually, that's an interesting question, because there were in Jerusalem, there were two groups of Jews. There were the pacifists, the ones who just said, basically, surrender to the Romans, give them whatever they want. At least we'll be able to stay alive and we'll be able to keep our temple. And then there were others who said, no, we're going to fight to the end. Now, Josephus, we know both from his own writings and from the writings of others, that Josephus was a pacifist, that Josephus wanted just to make up with the Romans and to kind of work out some kind of deal with the Romans. So therefore, think about this for a minute. Therefore, what Josephus does is he is chosen by Vespasian and by his son Titus to be the Jewish representative with them. They go to Jerusalem, and Vespasian and Titus believe that it's going to be Josephus who's going to be able to convince the Jews to surrender, to allow the Romans to enter Jerusalem. And basically, it'll be an easy path to victory for the Romans. Now, it doesn't work out that way. We're going to come back to that, exactly what happened. Why is it that they chose to destroy the temple? That's a fascinating, fascinating discussion. But the temple is destroyed, and the Jews are exiled from Jerusalem. Most of the Jews are sent to the north. Actually, the truth is that most of the Jews, Josephus tells us, are sent to cities of refuge. I'll just tell you, by way of a parenthesis, an interesting story. We know the famous Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai story. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, "Ten li Yavne v'chachamech," and he establishes a yeshiva in Yavne. You get the impression from the Gemara as if Yavne was this major Torah center. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai chooses that we're going to move the Torah center from Jerusalem to Yavne. Actually, Josephus tells us that Yavne actually was a refugee town. That's where the Jews were sent, where they were thrown out of Jerusalem. So actually what the rabbis do is they elevate the city of Yavne to the city of importance. But actually what Yavne was just a place where the refugees were sent after they were thrown out of Jerusalem. But that makes it all the more interesting, because Josephus is given the right to leave with Titus and to move to Rome. Very, very, very few, if any, Jews were given the right to move to Rome. I know we have the famous Arch of Titus with the Jews carrying what some people believe are the Klei HaMikdash, the articles from the temple, into Rome. But basically, the average Jew from Jerusalem was not allowed to move to Rome. The Romans in Rome did not want the Jews to be there. They felt that the Jews were not going to be beneficial to the Roman society. But Josephus was a favorite of Vespasian, who dies in 79, and then his son Titus. And he goes and he moves to Rome with them. And in Rome, he becomes a historian of the court. Basically, he's the one who writes the history of the wars of the Romans, specifically the wars of the Romans as they related to the Jews. And he lives in Rome, he writes these histories, and he lives there until sometime after the year 100. He dies, we don't have the exact date, but he dies in Rome sometime after the year 100. Now, his biography is complicated. His biography is complicated because it's not entirely clear whose side Josephus was on. And, when we're going to study him as a historian, it's going to be important to try to figure out. So was he loyal to the Jews? Was he basically a historian for Titus, but he remained a proud Jew and his history was loyal to the Jews? Or no, did he basically say, I'm going to become Titus's historian and I'm going to be, you know, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to become loyal to Titus and I'm not interested in what's good for the Jews or for Jewish history. Now that question is a very, very important question. And that's what I want to look at today. What was Titus's role as literally the first Jewish historian? And let me introduce that for a minute. You know, today when you think about people who write history, people who write politics, we all know that you say, this person has an agenda, right? This newspaper has an agenda. Everybody has an agenda. So it's interesting and important to know back 2,000 years that you want to try to figure out what was the agenda of this historian Josephus. Was his agenda to try to make the Jews look good to Titus? Or was his agenda to know? He was Titus's historian, and he didn't care about making the Jews look good. Now, that's an extremely important question, because Josephus, in many instances, is the only historical record that we have of this period leading up to the destruction of the temple. So the question of whether he's going to be what we would call today pro-Jewish or anti-Jewish is an extremely, extremely important question. Now, this question of Josephus and is he pro-Jewish or is he pro-Titus? Actually, this question has been asked for a long time. It's funny. In 1928, there were a series of lectures given at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati by an Anglican professor by the name of H. St. John Thackeray. Actually, the book still exists. It was republished by Kitab. It was a series of lectures. It was called Josephus, the Man and the Historian. And as sometimes happens in history, there's something that's written a long time ago. And all subsequent works, and there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of subsequent works on Josephus, are all based on these lectures that this Professor Thackeray gave in 1928. And Professor Thackeray basically lays out the issue. Was Josephus, we would say today, was he good for the Jews or was he bad for the Jews? And what I want to do is, I want to look, Josephus wrote several works. What I like doing is, in these, especially these Zoom classes, is rather than survey everything, which I often find to be too much on these Zoom classes, we'll have to, if I can, but schedule a new set of lectures to cover the books of Josephus that we don't cover this time. What I like to do is just to look at one work of Josephus, to look at it carefully, and to try to answer that question, was Josephus good for the Jews? Was Josephus loyal for the Jews, or was he interested in something else? If you give me 1 second, what I'm going to do is I am going to share with you. I'm going to share with you. Let's see if it works. It says loading, but it's not actually loading. Here we go. Okay, welcome everybody. Sorry that I lose many of you, but here we go. The War of the Jews. The history of the destruction of Josephus. Now, the first thing you should know is that the works of Josephus have been translated into English, and that you can buy the works of Josephus to this day. The War of the Jews, or the history of the destruction of Jerusalem. The first important point to know is that actually that title was not the original title. The original title was The War Against the Jews. The history of the destruction of Jerusalem, which sounds like it's written from the Roman perspective. But let's take one step at a time. The War of the Jews is actually a book written by Josephus that covers the period from the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, from the time of Hanukkah, around the year 164 BCE. leading all the way to the time of the destruction of the temple in the year 70 CE. When you think about that, wow, what an amazing 200 years in Jewish history. 200 years in Jewish history that we literally know nothing about. Now, the language of this book by Josephus that we have was originally written in Greek. It's interesting that it seems to be that originally, Thackeray says, Josephus wrote it in Aramaic. Was he on the payroll? It's a good question. That's a 21st century question. Was he on the payroll? The answer is no, he wasn't on the payroll. But in those days, they had a much better hold on you. You know, if you didn't do what you wanted, they just chopped off your head. So, you know, I guess probably you would consider that to be something similar to being on the payroll. But that's a good question. So he wrote it originally in Aramaic. That was the language of the Jews. Then when he was in Rome, he translated into Greek because that was the language of the people who lived during that period. Now, he presented this book, we know, to Vespasian and to Titus. We don't know what the reaction of Vespasian and Titus was to this book. But in the preface, he gives us a little bit of a sense of why he wrote this book. It is true, he says, these writers have the confidence to call their accounts histories. The first thing you learn from here is Josephus was not the only historian during this period. I'll tell you a little secret. There was another historian, Justus of Tiberias, a Jewish historian who was a contemporary of Josephus. He didn't like Josephus's history. He thought Josephus was too pro-Roman. So therefore, there was kind of a battle, kind of an academic battle between Josephus and this Justus of Tiberias, wherein yet they seem to me to fail of their own purpose, as well as to relate nothing that is sound. For they have a mind to demonstrate the greatness of the Romans, while they still diminish and lessen the actions of the Jews, as not discerning how it cannot be that those must appear to be great who have only conquered those who were little, nor are they ashamed to overlook the length of the war, the multitude of the Roman forces who so greatly suffered in it, or the might of the commanders whose great labors about Jerusalem will be deemed inglorious if what they achieve be reckoned but a small matter. Basically, what he says in that paragraph is that the other historians, either they overemphasize how great the Romans are, or they overemphasize how vicious the Romans were. However, I will not go to the other extreme. Out of opposition to those men who extol the Romans, nor will I determine to raise the actions of my countrymen too high, but I will prosecute the actions of both parties with accuracy. Now, that may not sound so surprising. I mean, you would say any good historian should say that in his preface. What he should say in his preface is that I'm going to be fair. I'm not going to be too pro-Roman. And neither will I raise the actions of my countrymen, of the Jews, too high. That's what you would expect, of course. But again, when you think about it during that period, there was no such thing as an academic historian. Every historian wrote with an agenda. Every historian, whether it was a Roman historian or whether it was a Jewish historian, they all wrote with an agenda. So the fact, and I'm not suggesting that Josephus didn't have an agenda. Josephus very well may have had an agenda. But the fact, and this is amazing, the fact that Josephus in his preface goes out of his way to say that I don't have an agenda is in itself fascinating, even if he actually does have an agenda. But the fact that he feels that his role as a historian is to present it as if he doesn't have an agenda is such an interesting, you know, so I would say far ahead of his time in terms of the way he presents history. So point number one in Josephus, again, this is not yet in the point of what his agenda was, but rather Josephus as a historian. Josephus presents it as if he was writing history, academic history. Academic history in the sense of being removed from having any sort of agenda. And responding to the question of, was he on the payroll? You wonder for a minute about what Titus thought about this kind of introduction. If I was Titus, I would probably have thought that the best way to handle it would be to, to say that I'm telling the story from the perspective of the Romans. Again, we don't know what Titus's reaction was, but given the fact that he lived in Rome under the thumb of Titus, it is interesting that he presents the history in the way that he does. Second, where am I going? Oh, here I'm going. Now, that's a good, what were Josephus' sources? So that's a very, very good question. Just take a second on that. Josephus doesn't tell us what his sources were. It's kind of in a way like the Rambam's halacha, just the Rambam tells you only what he says. He doesn't footnote it. Josephus doesn't footnote either. Again, we know that there were other histories that were written by others. But you have to remember that for a major period of this, Josephus was alive and he's describing his own experiences. He doesn't tell us what the sources were for the earlier period. That's also interesting. That actually suggests the fact that he wasn't such a historian in terms of telling you his sources. That's a good question. And now he says like this. This account I have given the reader, not so much with the intention of commending the Romans as of comforting those that have been conquered by them and for deterring others from attempting innovations under their government. This discourse of the Roman military conduct may also perhaps be of use to such of the curious as are ignorant of it, and yet have a mind to know it. I return now from the digression. It's fantastic. First of all, I return now from the digression. It is fantastic. But what he tells you here, just a little comment at the end of chapter 5. He says, I want to tell you, he says, you want to know why I'm writing this book? I want to write this book to comfort those who've been conquered by the Romans. Meaning that I know that there are some people who've been conquered by the Romans. I mean, you know, you're going to feel badly. I want to tell you, you know, the Jews were conquered by the Romans. Other people were conquered by the Romans. I want to let you know that the Romans are tough. It's okay if you were conquered by the Romans. And then the second piece, which is even more interesting. And for deterring others from attempting innovation under their government, which means, don't mess with the Romans. I'm writing this book to give everybody a warning. Don't mess with the Romans. So here you have it as introduction. I would say you have two very different kinds of approaches. One is this kind of academic removed approach, to say that I'm not writing from the perspective of the Romans, but I'm also not writing from the perspective of the Jews. I'm not going to tell you that the Romans were so great, and I'm not going to tell you the Jews were so great. But then he sticks here as what he calls a digression. He says, but I want to tell you, number one is, if you've been defeated by the Romans, don't feel so badly. The Romans are tough, right? That comfort those that have been conquered by them. And then I think the most interesting comment of all, and for deterring others from attempting innovations under their government. Meaning, if you are controlled by the, if you were controlled by the Romans, don't try to make innovations under their government. It's going to be unsuccessful. Just accept them for whom they are. Now, that's interesting. This Josephus doesn't describe. But we know that at the beginning of the second century, the end of the first century and the beginning of the second century, we know the story of Bar Kokhba. We know that the Jews, even after the destruction of the Second Temple, didn't give up. They actually waged several rebellions of their own against the Romans. So there's no question that Josephus is against those rebellions. Josephus remains a pacifist even after the destruction of the temple. And he basically warns the people, including the Jews, don't mess around with the Romans. Now, what I want to spend the rest of the class doing is I want to study something which is going to appear, I think, to many people, including myself, kind of surprising. If I ask you who destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash, we're coming up to the summer, it's almost Tisha B'Av, the question of who destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash, I think we would all say, and I would include myself in this group, that the person who destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash were the Romans. Titus destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash. If I were to go through the Talmudic sources, the Midrashic sources, it's explicit in those sources that Titus destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Now, with that knowledge, it's amazing to see what Josephus writes. But Titus said, I'm in the underline here, 241. But Titus said, and this is Titus speaking to his group of people. They're standing there, they're sitting there on the eve of the destruction of the temple. And Titus says to the Jews, Titus says to his group of officers, although the Jews should mount that holy house and fight us from it, yet we ought not to revenge ourselves on things that are inanimate instead of on the men themselves. He says, the Jews are going to fight us from the temple, but we should not take revenge on inanimate objects, on buildings, instead of on the men themselves. And that he was not in any case for burning down so vast a work as that was, because this would be a loss to the Romans themselves, as it would be an ornament to their government if it stood. Wow. This paragraph is a total wow. In this paragraph, Josephus tells us this Titus tries to convince his people that the Romans should not destroy the temple themselves. Number one, they shouldn't destroy the temple themselves because let's not take out our revenge on inanimate objects. Let's punish the people, not the building. And the second reason, which arguably is a more significant reason, is that the temple will be an ornament to their government if it stands. It's like parading the king. It's like a god parading the king through the streets. What could be better if you parade the losing king through the streets? So if we keep the temple and we say, look, we conquered the temple, what could be better for everybody? And then look on the other side, 251. Just let me see that question. Yes, that's correct. These flames, however, were ignited by the Jews themselves and were occasioned by them. What Josephus writes is that the Jews themselves burnt down the temple. For upon Titus's retiring, the rebels lay still for a little while, and then attacked the Romans again. And when those who guarded the holy house fought with those who quenched the fire that was burning in the inner court of the temple, but these Romans put the Jews to flight and proceeded as far as the holy house itself. Basically, what he describes is that the Jews themselves lit the fire in the temple, right? Then attacked the Romans again when those who guarded the holy house fought with those who quenched the fire that was burning the inner court of the temple. Sounds like, he doesn't say it explicitly, but it sounds like there was a battle of the Jews within the temple itself. Some Jews decided we should burn down the temple than have the Romans burn down the temple. And there were those who say, no, we have to put out the fire. However you understand that, and that's not entirely clear here from Josephus, it is absolutely clear, crystal clear here in Josephus, that Titus is against the Romans destroying the temple, and that the temple is destroyed by the Jews who lit the fire in the temple. Again, it's not entirely clear. Just for a second, look at 250. But as for that house, God had for certain long ago doomed it to fire. And now that fatal day had come according to the revolution of years. It was the 10th day of the month, Av, upon which it was formerly burnt by the king of Babylonia. Now, that line before, I didn't underline it, but now I want to go back to it for a second. You see, Josephus really tells us two things. Josephus tells us that the Jews burnt the temple. And Josephus said that that's the way God wanted. Not that God burnt the temple, but that's the way God wanted it. So the Romans didn't burn the temple. The Jews burnt the temple, but it's what God really wanted. It seems to be, and again, you'll see this very clearly in 1 second when I turn the page, seems to be that what Josephus is concerned about is to make sure that it's very clear that Titus is not responsible for the burning of the temple. Exactly who and how and why the temple was destroyed, well, that's, that seems to be a little unclear in Titus. Was it God, and therefore it just happened because God said that's the day the temple will be destroyed, the same day it was destroyed by the Babylonians? Was it Jews who were really fighting among themselves about whether or not it's better to burn the temple themselves rather than let the Romans burn the temple? That's not entirely clear. Because what's important to Josephus is that it's not Titus's fault. Exactly how and what and why the Jews destroyed the temple seems to be of secondary importance. I see a few notes that are coming up. Everything you're saying is right. It might have been the Sakari. You're right that Josephus became the source of the gospel, all of that. And somebody wrote, I saw that Josephus had an imagination. I mean, the truth of the matter is, and this is what makes this stuff so great, who had the imagination exactly? Did Josephus have the imagination? Did the rabbis have the imagination? Right? It's just not clear. And you say, was this, the person just wrote me, it says, who rewrote history? Did Josephus rewrite history or did the rabbis rewrite history? Well, we'll come back to that in 1 minute, but I want to tell you something. That's not so clear that Josephus is the one who rewrote history. If you want to know the truth, Josephus lived through the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. So at least in terms of firsthand knowledge, Josephus has better knowledge than anybody else. Now, it's true that he may have had an agenda, but Josephus has better firsthand knowledge than anybody else. But this stuff is only interesting. When we compare it to a historian who lived in the 4th century CE, that historian's name is Sulpicius Simplicius. Now, who is that? Sulpicius Severus, his name is, I apologize. A Christian historian who lived in southern Italy, right? Southern Italy, south of Rome. He wrote a history of the Roman Empire. And he included in his history of the Roman Empire a history of the destruction of Jerusalem. Remember, by the 4th century, he's writing as a Christian historian. The 4th century, actually, just a breath for a second, the 4th century is really the beginning, just the beginning of Christianity. Christianity is not a world power yet. But this historian, Severus, is not writing as a Roman, he's writing as a Christian. And it's here on the bottom in English. Meanwhile, the Jews, hemmed in by the siege, you see where I'm reading, since no opportunity for peace or surrender had been given, at last perished of hunger. And everywhere the roads began to be filled with corpses, so that the duty of burying them could not be performed. It is said, and here's the key, that Titus summoned his council, and before taking action, consulted it whether he should overthrow a sanctuary of such workmanship, since it seemed to many that a sacred building, one more remarkable than any other human work, should not be destroyed. That was Josephus. That's the explanation Josephus gave for why they didn't destroy the temple. For if preserved, it would testify to the moderation of the Romans, while if demolished, it would be a perpetual sign of cruelty. On the other hand, others, and Titus himself, expressed their opinion that the temple should be destroyed without delay, in order that the religion of the Jews and Christians should be more completely exterminated. For those religions, though opposed to one another, derived from the same founders. The Christians stemmed from the Jews, and the extirpation of the root would easily cause the offspring to perish. Wow. Wow. What this guy, Severus, 4th century Christian, says, well, he suggests Josephus's reason that Titus and the Romans wouldn't want to destroy the temple because it was such an amazing work, it was such an amazing building that it would be a feather in their cap to keep it standing and to say we conquered this building. But then in 7 he says that Titus himself, and this is against Josephus, Titus himself expressed his opinion that the temple should be destroyed without delay. It was Titus's idea, exactly the opposite of what Josephus said. According to this guy, Severus, it was Titus's idea that they destroy the temple. But look at his agenda. You see, according to this guy, Severus, the reason Titus wanted to destroy the temple was because he wanted, by destroying the temple, to get rid of the Jews and the Christians. I want to tell you a little secret that most of you know. And that is that in the year 70, the Christians were not a factor. The Christians had barely begun in any sense of being a sect in the year 70. I don't know why the temple was destroyed. I'm not sure what Titus's agenda was in destroying the temple. But I know one thing for sure. What I know is that Titus was not interested in the Christians in 70 CE when he destroyed the temple. The Christians only came much later. But you see, in the year 400, when Severus writes this Christian history, what he wants to do is he wants to show everybody how bad the Romans were. You know, the Roman pagans became Christians. But at least within early Christianity, what the early Christians wanted to do was to show that that pagan Rome was corrupt and evil and no good. So there was nothing better in Severus's mind than to say that Titus was a bad guy. How bad was Titus? Well, he wanted to destroy the temple. Why did he want to destroy the temple? He wanted to destroy the temple because he wanted to destroy Judaism and Christianity. Now, why do I give you these two sources? So if we take a step back, I think we learn something very important about history and historians in this early period. You see, Severus plays his hand too open here. If you want to know whether Severus is telling you the truth about Titus, I have the following things to say. Number one is he's writing in the year 400. He's writing maybe based on the history of Tacitus, an early Roman historian, but it's not clear at all. So number one is he's writing from history. He's not writing, it's not an eyewitness account. That's number one. But much more importantly, clearly he has an agenda. His agenda is Christianity. He's not interested in whether Titus actually burnt down the temple or not. He's interested in the way the Christians see it, and the Christians should think that Titus burnt down the temple because he wanted to destroy Judaism and Christianity. And therefore, if you compare Josephus's account with Severus's account, I think we really can gain some insight into what it meant to be a historian in these early centuries. And that is, you know, Josephus, did he have an agenda? Josephus, was he on the payroll of Titus? Was he afraid to tell the truth because he was afraid that Titus would kill him? Was he afraid to tell the truth, or did he choose not to tell the truth because he basically became a Roman? Or did he on some level remain patriotic and loyal to the Jews? The answer is I can't tell you exactly. But what I can tell you is that unlike Severus in the year 400, who clearly is writing a religious history with a clear religious agenda, Josephus doesn't play it that way. Josephus plays it as if he's writing a history which, as he wrote in the introduction, is a balanced history. Not praising the Romans too much, not praising the Jews too much, maybe in a sense deterring those, just warning people about how strong the Romans were. Is he telling me the truth about Titus? Is his story that Titus didn't destroy the temple, but that the Jews destroyed the temple, or God wanted the temple to be destroyed? Is that the true story? Or is the true story that, like the Gemara says, that Titus himself destroyed the temple? We say in the keynotes all over the place that, you know, that Titus destroyed the temple. What's the true story? The answer is, I don't know what the true story is. I know that Josephus was an eyewitness. And I know that Josephus claims to be writing an academic history of the period. Was he not? So as I said, this has been a matter of debate since the year 1928, since the lectures at Hebrew Union College, the Thackeray lectures at Hebrew Union College. And to this day, we don't really know the answer. But I think what we do see here is something extremely important and something that is worthy of note when we look at the history of Second Temple literature. And that's the fact that Josephus is the first historian who at least claims to be writing a history of the people, not a history from a Jewish perspective and not a history from a Roman perspective, but a history from the perspective of an eyewitness who saw all these events. It's interesting that throughout Jewish history, the book of Josephus was never used. Josephus was not seen as someone who was part of the rabbinic tradition. He's not quoted in the Gemara. And throughout the Middle Ages, Josephus is not used. However, in the 10th century in Italy, there was a book that was written that was called Sefer Yosipon. Now, this Sefer Yosipon is not an Hebrew translation of the book of Josephus, but it probably is a Hebrew book that is based on the stories of Josephus. This book, Sefer Yosipon, and just go into Bar Ilan or Otar HaChochma and just put in Sefer Yosipon, or probably even into Google, and you will see that Sefer Yosipon is quoted all over the place by the Rishonim. Actually, when the Rishonim, when the medieval halachists want to quote something in history, want to say this happened in history, the source they use is the book of Yosipon. And that's an amazing thing, because the author of the book of Yosipon, we don't know exactly who that was, but the author of the book of Yosipon, he basically gave a hashgacha to the work of Josephus. Now again, the book of Yosipon is written in a totally pro-Jewish perspective, but at least the stories on some level are based on the stories of Josephus. So what we have is Josephus, a first century historian for whom it's not clear what his agenda was, but he was an eyewitness to the destruction of the temple and to the events leading to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. This is not an important work in Jewish history because he wasn't accepted by the rabbinic tradition. It became an important work because it was adapted and adopted by the author of Sefer Yosipon, a book that is quoted. So on one hand, we're introduced today to the first Jewish secular historian in history, Josephus. And at the same time, we're introduced to the person who at least indirectly led to the Jewish understanding of history throughout the Middle Ages. And really, actually, until the time of the Enlightenment, the only introduction that many, many parts of the Jewish community had to history. So just an introduction, again, of course, Josephus deserves an entire semester, if not more than a semester. There's been an amazing amount of work that's been done on Josephus. Professor Louis Feldman, who was my professor in Yeshiva University and may have been many other people's professor in Yeshiva University, was a great expert in Josephus. There's an amazing amount of work on Josephus. Comparing Josephus to the rabbis is interesting. Comparing Josephus to the Christian historians, which we did today, is fascinating. But hopefully today I gave just a little bit of an introduction to who Josephus was and why he's important. Next week, we'll return to the rabbis. And let's look at least at the early Mishnah, the Mishnah that was written during the time of the First Temple, and see what its role is as literature of the Second Temple period. Have a good week, everybody. Stay safe. And I look forward to seeing you next Sunday morning.
Thank you, Rabbi. A couple of issues in the chat box, if you'd like to address. I don't think you
okay,
got.
Okay, I will look at the chat box. 1 second. Thank you, Rabbi. Thanks from Uruguay. Marcelo, how are you doing, my friend? Let's see what it says. You said last week that the canonization of Jewish texts was in response to Christianity. When did they become, as you said today, a factor? When did what become a factor? The Christian text? I mean, once the gospel became a Christian, the Tanakh was canonized around the year 100. Immediately, the Tanakh became a factor. Isn't the 4th century the time of the Talmud's development? Yes, but the Talmud is developed in Babylonia, has no connection to Christianity at all. He was a man torn by ambition, unfortunately, to save his skin, wore 2 faces. Yeah, that's correct, of course. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Have a great week, everybody, and I look forward to seeing you in the future.